Good evening. Let me start out by thanking for the invitation. I'm very happy to be here. I'm also delighted to have seen the movie and heard your lovely words, Adania, on the more recent references to the Hijaz Railroad. What I'm going to do here is to take you 100 years back to the history of the railroad. Okay, Hijaz Railroad can be considered the ultimate and most ambitious expression of Ottoman modernity, which has a long process that goes back to 1839, to the declaration of the Tanzimat Charter, Tanzimat literally meaning putting in order. What I have on the screen is a medal celebrating the completion of one line on this web, and on the right is a stamp that celebrates the 125th anniversary of the declaration of Tanzimat with three of its architects. An important goal of the extensive Tanzimat reforms was to redefine and connect the empire by means of modernization, centralization, and uniformity. Through laws, regulations, administrative measures, institutions, infrastructure projects, and architecture, the relatively independent provinces of the Ottoman Empire were to be pulled together and controlled effectively according to a new imperial vision. Hence, a new governance system was established, deconstructing the autonomy enjoyed by the provinces in the pre-modern era. I would like to start out by quickly illustrating the physical, the architectural manifestations of the centralization policies with a series of randomly selected examples from the Arab provinces of the empire. The buildings symbolize the Ottoman state mentality of the 19th century and are intertwined with policy shifts, bringing a secular and imperial monumentality to urban fabrics. They include government palaces and other government offices, such as landholding and tax collection offices, and municipal buildings. On the top, we have the government palaces in Beirut and Jaffa. At the bottom, two other government offices from Mosul and Sana'a, to give you the variation. From these buildings, the new administrative system assured the application of the new laws and regulations. The post and telegraph offices linked all settlements to Istanbul, the capital. Other building types comprised of hospitals and schools. They included hospitals and schools. Hospitals were important, and an impressive number were built throughout the empire. They operated according to modern practices, even though they looked quite different. On the left is the municipal hospital, the hospital for the poor, actually, in Damascus. And on the right, a similar building, this time in Sana'a, Yemen. School buildings, of which I'm showing you two at the bottom, embodied the architectural reforms of the Imperial High School on the left and another high school in Baghdad on the right. Perhaps more than any other building, clock towers served as symbols of the new order. Built mostly during the reign of Abdülhamid II and in many architectural styles, like the other buildings I showed you, the towers announced the unity of the empire through time. On the top, starting from the left, a generic design for a clock tower, and then the clock towers in Aleppo and Beirut. At the bottom, Jerusalem, Jaffa, and Tripoli of Libya. I think of the clock towers as metaphorically pinning down the imperial map in an effort to keep it under control. It's a very visual thing. Train stations complemented this repertory of modernity. They ranged in scale and architectural ambition and marked a string of stops along the rail lines, the concrete realization of the unification of the empire. We're looking at the train station in Damascus above and in Medina below. And now Aleppo on the top and Haifa. At the bottom, I believe it is Beirut, and I can't remember the one on the right. We've seen some of these similar ones, similar train stations in the film that Rania showed us. Rail lines physically linked the different regions to each other and to the capital, also reaching key points on the coast, such as the port of Beirut, which was under construction then. If the whole empire could not be woven with rails in the short run, priorities tell a lot about the intention. Economic gain was a main consideration. For example, the Haifa-Damascus line passing through the most fertile valleys of Palestine would, according to an official document, constitute an export route for the produce cultivated by the people of the region. In addition, it would support religious tourism to the Holy Land by Christian pilgrims. The branch to Mecca and Medina would facilitate Muslim pilgrimage, accommodate political and ideological agendas, but also serve for... Excuse me? Oh, okay. You were not talking to me, I guess. Okay, the branch to Mecca and Medina would facilitate Muslim pilgrimage, accommodate political and ideological agendas, but also serve military purposes. Now, this was the Hijaz Railroad proper, although the entire regional network gradually became known under the name. Construction of the Syrian network began in the 1890s. The Hijaz branch was announced on May 1, 1900 by an imperial decree on the birthday of Abdülhamid II and occupies a unique place in the history of the late Ottoman Empire. Connecting Damascus to Mecca and Medina, this sacred line, Hatt-ı Mübareke, was to be an exclusively Muslim enterprise. It would rely on Muslim funding, be planned and supervised by Muslim engineers, and be built by Muslim workers using local materials. Not all of these goals could be achieved, but I believe they say a lot about the intent of the project. Okay. The Hijaz Railroad marked a break from the usual practices of railroad projects in Ottoman lands and was an attempt to make a statement about the new identity of the empire, associating modernization directly with ideological and political agendas laced with religion. Its ostensive raison d'etre was to make the pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina easier, shorter, and cheaper, in support of Abdülhamid's pan-Islamist policies, which had turned Istanbul's attention to the Arab provinces and emphasized his leadership of Muslims. The Hijaz Railroad did not have an economic justification. It would serve only seasonal traffic, and there was no agricultural production in the regions through which it ran. Indeed, the Hijaz region had always been an economic burden on the Ottoman state and continued to be so. It was exempt from taxes, and its administrative and military expenses were huge. There were additional external political reasons aside from pilgrimage for the decision to build this line. The British occupation of Egypt in 1882 and British control of the Suez Canal had urged the Ottomans to pay military and strategic attention to the area. With the completion of the Hejaz Railroad, the Ottoman state could send troops directly to Arabia if needed, and along the way, challenge the special status historically enjoyed by the emirs of Mecca, whose independence had increased by the turn of the century. The Ottoman railways are entangled with the story of rampant capitalism and European economic and strategic interests in the Middle East. The financially strained Ottoman state gave concessions to foreign companies to build and run the empire's railroads. The British, French, and German companies may have grabbed bits and pieces of the big project, but really the project belonged to Ottomans as they commissioned the foreign companies, dictated their operations, and stipulated all conditions. And the umbrella title of the project, Hamidiye Hijaz Demiryolu, celebrated Sultan Abdülhamid II. Let me go to this map. Due to the presence of too many actors, too many regulations, dire financial troubles, and the fragmented nature of the construction, there were inevitable problems. Not in the least, the varying success of completion, which resulted in an unfinished web. This map shows you the completed and uncompleted parts of it. On the eve of World War I, many crucial connections remained unachieved. For example, the Ma'an, Aqaba, Medina, Mecca, and Mecca, Jeddah lines. The last one, very important because it was to connect to the main pilgrimage port. Jeddah. But in any case, the Medina-Mecca line was not finished either. Matters were complicated further by the fact that some lines had normaled with rails 1.5 meters, while others were 1 meter wide. And sometimes one railway built by one company would come and hit the other one built by another company, and there would be a difference in the rail, so the trains had to be changed. The lack of coordination could have been avoided by careful inspection of regulations governing the concessions and was representative of the Ottoman government's failure to pursue its reform agendas in practice. Ottoman modernity was a fractured and rather idiosyncratic one. Still, the impact of the landscape, the impact on the landscapes the rail crossed was aggressive and had created a major network of settlements, large and small, incorporating them into a system. The results were visually impressive. Aside from the linear intervention that seemed to have no end, the bridges and the tunnels that accentuated them with their daring technology changed the countryside in unprecedented ways in over a rather short period of time. The different landscapes and the wide range of geographies they cut through attested, affirmed the vastness of the empire. Such views provoke me to imagine the impact of the project on local people. While it is impossible to give voice to ordinary people who encountered the rapid transformation of their countryside, is it reasonable to speculate that the rails, the bridges, the tunnels, and the work involved in their construction made the Ottoman state and the Sultan himself a concrete reality, as opposed to a faraway abstract reference? Did their association with cutting-edge technology endow them with a new kind of power? I'm very well aware that such questions cannot be answered by evidence. archival material, but I find it worthwhile to think about them. The overall visual impact of the Hijaz Railroad contributed to the redefinition of the Ottoman Empire, hence served as a propaganda tool. It was documented extensively thanks to another new technology, photography. Photographs of the Hijaz Railroad were diffused widely in an official effort to associate the image of the empire with it, the Camera Ottomana working in contradiction to the Camera Orientalis. The latter continued to focus on exotica, ignoring anything that was modern in the empire. Taken by local studios, the Ottoman photographs belong to a thematic genre that is only recently being taken seriously by scholars of visual culture. The images on the screen are really fantastic, I think. The one on the left shows you a bridge under construction in Palestine, and the one on the right is the inauguration, part of the inauguration ceremony for the for a memorial, sort of a statue complex erected for the arrival of the trains to Haifa. Royal patronage then was at the center of photographic documentation, stemming largely from Sultan Abdülhamid's personal interest in photography. His archive, now housed in Istanbul University's Rare Works Collection, contains over 30,000 images, some bound in albums, others loose. Among them, photographs of the Hijaz Railroad occupy the largest category, and I have been using them so far. These photographs did not remain locked in the palace. Due to the easily reproducible character of the medium, copies found their ways to other outlets addressing different groups of people. For example, there are albums organized to show one region. One, now in the Ömer Koç collection, covers two branches of the Hijaz Railroad, the north-south stretch from Damascus to Man. Can you read it? I don't think you can read the numbers. I had them all. Oops, that's terrible. I'll move. We won't be able to read the numbers. I lost my train of thought here. Okay, there we are. But you'll have to use your knowledge of local geography for this. It takes two branches of the railroad, the north-south stretch from Damascus to Man, and the segment from Dara to Haifa, both completed in 1905. The album has a straightforward format. It starts with the Man line moving from Damascus to Man and continues with the Haifa line going westward. It includes photographs of bridges under construction and finished, work scenes showing the opening of trenches, and newly opened tunnels. Note that I'm showing you some of the photographs that I already showed you, which were drawn from the Sultan's albums. Captions give information on the exact location of the point depicted in the photograph. The images and text coalesce into a didactic journey for people unfamiliar with and far away from the regions. Such albums served as tools to unite the empire, again, by providing knowledge about its dispersed territories and reiterating the imperial claim and control over them through advanced technology. Claim. I would like you to look at this arm here. The Ottoman officers saying, this is ours. And the photographs show a lot of Ottoman civil servants on the tracks, flaunting the railroads. Although it's not possible to trace how many copies were produced and how they circulated, there is sufficient evidence that they reached the upper echelons of the Ottoman society and were given to foreigners as gifts. The photographs were also illustrated in popular, were also printed in popular illustrated periodicals. Accompanied by textual information and sometimes with maps, I'm showing you one, knowledge about the project was disseminated to broader audiences. Journals such as Servet-i Fünun, Malumat, and Şehbal reported frequently on its progress, always linking it to the power of the Sultan and signaling its imperial character. This is an interesting map. It's a little bit difficult to make sense of it, but Damascus is down here, and it goes all the way to Dara, and then the red part is the unbuilt part. At the turn of the century, Servet-i Fünun started a series on the construction by resimler, pictures, sort of a report on the work in progress. Issue by issue, and like in the Ömer Koç album, it covered photographs, it covered the photographs by the points it reached, the railroad reached, the bridges under construction. What happened? The bridges, let me see, under construction, the stations, the materials transported, the trenches dug, and on the left you have the materials, and on the right the locomotives which carried everything, as well as the inaugural ceremonies. The innumerable occasions for ceremonies offered by the Hijaz Railroad reinforced its unique status among imperial projects, and the press coverage kept interest in its progress alive over the years and across the distances. The start and completion of any given stretch, any bridge and tunnel, and any station created another chance to affirm the greatness and benevolence of Abdülhamit, his commitment to Arab provinces, as well as the unification of the empire. Under temporary wooden arches decorated with flags and branches, prayers were recited, speeches were made, and medals were distributed. Some ceremonies were fancier than others. The arrival of trains to Beirut created the opportunity for an elegant feast with a cake in the form of a locomotive in the place of honor. Padişahım çok yaşa, long live the Sultan, written on it. It saluted the Sultan in Istanbul. Meanwhile, the presence of many workers in the photographs remind us of the labor history of the project. Let me show you one more. And random shots of travelers trigger us to imagine the traveling conditions. Over time, Servet-i Fünun's coverage accumulated into a visual history of the Hijaz Railroad, with the caption constituting the only textual information. The photographic survey thus highlighted different aspects of the project: technical, scientific, social, political, and above all, imperial. The journal acted as the messenger of the state in encapsulating the totality of the Hamidian ambitions behind the Hijaz Railroad. A special double issue of Servet-i Fünun, dedicated to the Hijaz Railroad in 1902, flaunted a telling drawing on its cover. The image is framed by an arch adorned with motifs derived from Ottoman tile designs and crowned by the crescent and the star. The composition evokes European drawings of Islamic art forms, notably designs by Owen Jones, but also many others. The drawing shows a modern bridge, the kind that Servet-i Fünun had familiarized its readers with many photographs, through a typically Arab landscape evoked by barren mountains in the background and palm trees. The reference is specifically to the line going toward Medina, the heart of the project. Locals crowd the foreground, some in their tribal costumes, others distinguished by their religious attire. They welcome this feat with open arms, seemingly expressing their gratitude with prayer. Among the crowd, one figure in European costume and wearing a fez, right here, unmistakably a high Ottoman officer, represents the imperial administrations. The tents refer to the regional nomadic tribes, and the camels peacefully resting complete the blissful, the Orientalist scene, I should say. The whole picture displays the Ottoman enterprise of bringing civilization to the Arabian Peninsula, not unlike the French colonial Mission Civilisatrice. Nevertheless, read against the widespread hostility to the project, this image seems to be wishful thinking. We can even look at it as an ironic commentary on the real state of the affairs. I'm thinking of the resistance of the emirs of Mecca and the Bedouins, the former fearing that the arrival of the trains would reinforce Ottoman authority and lead to the loss of their autonomy, and the latter worrying about their economic livelihood. As the unique providers of accommodation, food and transportation on camels in the region until then, the tribes depended on pilgrims for income. They were not happy. They began by destroying rails and stoning trains. Assaults on construction crews followed. Construction was protected by military groups whose numbers increased from 5,000 in 1906 to 15,000 in 1908. One night in July 1908 alone, Bedouins killed 300 soldiers. The history of Hijaz Railroad is too complicated to fit into this relatively short lecture. I highlighted briefly several themes which I consider especially important: imperiality, identity, economy, political power, ideology, and class. I hope they help us in conceptualizing a usable past for this piece of infrastructure. Thank you.